really enjoyed a lot the discussion at the Hammer about straight time, about, what was it, 3 months ago, 4 months ago?
Jesus.
Yeah. Yourself and...
A lot longer.
Maybe like, that was.
You're like me. You're
oh, I mean, this was like last spring or something, and
that's
I'm...
Like
and
a year ago.
Okay.
I'm
a year ago.
I'm the same way. Oh, good. Thank you.
I really like
it. Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah. I saw it way back when. And then I got the DVD, and I've seen it like...
Because I thought no one saw it when it was originally released. Because Warner's didn't.
Yeah.
They buried it.
That was a first artist, one
yes.
of your...
Yes. That was the first, and then I heard they did. It was so difficult with that picture that I hurriedly did the second one to get out of the contract, which was Agatha.
You know, it's funny. I haven't seen that ever since that one time I saw it at the Cinema One way back when.
Agatha?
Has that been on DVD or anything? I haven't seen Hide Nor Hair.
That's a good question. Amanda? Amanda, will you stay there? Will you find out if Agatha, the film I did, was ever put on DVD or VHS? I don't know.
VHS, I really like the vibe in here. I don't know what it is. It's the table, it's the... No, it's just... Nice.
This, I'll confess, this was raw space when I saw it. And they had 2 years ago, they had... raw space, like concrete floor, nothing. These offices, and then they had... We think we were like the penthouse, but it's a view of the whole city. And I said, I like this, but I can watch people on the street, and I can watch people, I can watch people.
Mm-hmm.
So we were renovating our house at the same time, and the contractor at one point said, you know, why don't you just put everything you were taken out? So that's all the stuff is, well, you can't see now, but when we get done, of these doors, everything is from the house. So we just, everything. In fact, the next room was a fireplace, and we just used it for books, and we put a TV in. So that saved a lot of money.
I just love
yeah, this stuff I've always loved, and I love metal stuff too.
Yeah.
That was a dentist's cabinet, and I think the table outside where you were sitting was used at a morgue. You think it's got wheels?
Have you had a chance? By the way, I wanted to tell you, I want to detour right at the end, so if I could. Do you know how long we have?
What
roughly?
What do you want?
I want to detour at the very end and ask a couple of questions for a Politico piece.
Yeah. Do you want about an hour enough?
Oh, more than enough, sure.
Good. Okay, so let's figure an hour.
Yeah. Okay. Have you seen Last Chance Harvey with a regular paying audience? Have you gone...
Yes, but I wouldn't call them regular.
Recruited?
Recruited isn't regular, right?
Yeah.
So, and they were, and it was not, it was temp track, and it was not... I saw... Once the finished product, which is the color corrected and the final mix, I saw it once about a week ago. And I was asked to do a Q&A for this guy, John, something or other, and it was on Lancashire Boulevard, and it was AFTRA. So 600, it's a beautiful theater, 600 seats, but those people, I think many of them were industry people. So I
had, Pete Hammond.
That's right.
Pete Hammond, yes. He's a friend. Yeah.
And it was a really terrific evening.
Yeah.
But I felt he'll probably be able to tell you if that's, because he's showing a lot of movies. I think they're industry people, aren't they?
Yeah, they're a good portion anyway.
So regular audience, I always like to sneak in once the... opens and stand in the back or sit in the back and see what a regular audience does.
So I think it's the best thing you've gotten hold of since Wag the Dog, maybe, or before that? Because it's more than Wag, because Wag the Dog wasn't really a lead. This is like a lead, and it's a real, you know, empathetic lead. So where should I go? To Hero, maybe? I don't know. It's something. It's around then. It's been a while. It's like 12, 13 years.
Really?
Well, Hero is 95, right?
It's going to be a depressing interview. I'm trying to think what I did. Well, there's Fockers.
Yeah, but that wasn't a lead either, really. I mean, you were the
kind of an
antagonist.
Ensemble.
But,
ensemble.
Yeah.
So you mean a real lead.
you know, you're carrying the weight. It's about you.
Or as a guy I was talking to yesterday, a writer-director said, the one who has the narrative drive of the picture. I'd have to look at a sheet of my credits, because you may be right, but I can get them. What have I done since Wagner? Well, there was Sphere, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
And that was the lead. But the film didn't work.
I mean, isn't it, frankly,
An Outbreak, but I don't know what year that was. But maybe it
horror is. Film. Action horror film.
Yeah, so, yeah. This is, well, in terms of a romantic lead or something, yeah, my goodness.
There's something where you can feel the beating heart.
Yeah. Years. I mean, you know, if you don't develop it yourself, it doesn't come down the pipe to people in my age bracket. They tend to go to, you know, 20s, even their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. You know, you wind up kind of, reach a certain age, you wind up supporting the way you started out, you know. And then you wind up supporting, unless you have, and Em and I found a way to, you know, because we did Stranger Than Fiction. And we only had two scenes, and the director, who was a friend, Mark Forster, told us that he had to cut the last scene, the second scene, in half, because it was too intense and it took away from the romantic leads, which was Will Ferrell and Maggie Gyllenhaal. And we liked the scene, and we were sorry to see it go. And Em and I said, at that point, it'd be nice to find something to do. And we both had that in our head, and then she went back to England, and I think she knew Joel Hopkins and mentioned it to him. I don't know if she mentioned anybody else, but he came back with this project, which we then kind of built, the three of us together. You know, because it was, particularly my character was quite different, and because he didn't know me. He knew Emma, so he knew she writes. In fact, she's doing a screenplay now. And in answer to your question, this wouldn't have happened probably if we didn't prod it along, you know, instigate it.
It's nice that it got bumped into this year. It was going to be an 09 release, and I understand from reaction they felt, well, this is something we should put out in December.
I think maybe that's true, yeah.
At least that's what I got the impression.
Yes, I think you're right, yeah.
From the people that were sharing.
Yeah.
Which is good. Glad to have,
when did you see it?
I saw it at a screening room on Wilshire Boulevard about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
So you saw 10th Track too? You didn't see the finish line.
I guess I didn't. It didn't seem ragged or anything.
Well, he fixed certain things. And you didn't see the final print.
No.
Which is always curious to me, because the cinematographers work so hard, and you see a pristine print, and it's an extraordinary. And in a week or two, all the projectors will
shoot it
up. You know?
It's the best way you can see a film is either in a screening room, of course, with a festival.
Yes.
And you know that you're going to get, first of all, it's not just the look of it, but it's also because the audiences are very attuned.
Yes.
Oh, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
And that's the best way to.
Did you have a good response? Was it? How many people?
Well, it's
just a few.
30, 25.
Yeah, something.
Yeah. I wish I'd been at that Pete Hammett screening. I heard about that. He told me it went over gangbusters.
Yeah, it was interesting to sit in the back seat. I snuck in after it started. And, you know, they had a seat for me in the back, so it's gently raked, so I could see everybody. And to watch the film and to watch the people, you didn't see movement, and that is unusual, because in regular movie houses you see a lot of movement, whether it's going to the bathroom or just getting popcorn, but it had, from the backs of people's heads, it had a kind of attentive feeling that plays have when people are watching a play. So it was at that point I thought, this is as good as it gets.
You know what kicks in emotionally, I think, is the thing. This is an interesting scheme that the movie does, but basically
What did you say, scheme?
A scheme.
Oh, scheme.
The strategy.
Yes, yes.
Which is that I was very angered by, I felt, with it was more than rudeness. It was cruelty on the part of your daughter and Jim Brolin. You know, because I felt there was, unless you had chopped off children's heads, while sodomizing them, why would they treat you so, you know, inhospitably? So I understand that there are, well, we all have our back issues and everything, but I was very angry about that. And then, but I was immensely touched, and that's what melts me about the whole film, is when you have your moment at the end. Instead of responding to that very, very indecent way they treated you, it's a very classy and generous thing that you give off when you say them. And there's no tit for tat. In other words, you sort of rise above where it had been. And, you know, kind of a Barack Obama type of thing. It's, you know, in other words, you're not
just thinking,
you know.
Yes.
It's nice. That's what kind of made me, but that's the perhaps the most profound emotional thing about it. Anyway.
There was some more dialogue that, in the course of writing and in shooting, I mean, you know, it's ultimately the director's prerogative. And there, because we all, you know, especially in something like this, Emma and I, we each have our backstory that we contribute. Mm-hmm. And there was there were lines to the effect that it had not, it had been an acrimonious divorce when it happened, and that the daughter was used as a, at least from my character's point of view, was used as a weapon to the extent that, which they have books written that way, in fact.
About how not to do that with your kids?
Well, the parents do that. I mean, there's, you know, when there's acrimony involved, and there's, you know, I mean, to put it succinctly, when we did Kramer versus Kramer, Bob Benton used a real stenographer in the court scenes. And because I asked her, I said, boy, are you an actor? Because you're doing that pretty well. She said, no, I am a stenographer. I said, oh, so you do that on a daily basis? She says, yeah. I said, I says, like, what kind of cases? She says, well, I used to do divorce, but not anymore. I do homicides now. Hmm. And I said, how can you switch? She says, because homicide is much easier. She says, divorce is just too
ferocious.
It's too painful to be a part of, be in that room.
Yeah.
And so, in this case, the backstory, and it was, you don't know how much to put in, I guess, or the director, you know, he just wants to suggest. But there was, you know, to the extent that at one point I faded from her life, and because I didn't want to fight back using her as a weapon, and I didn't want her to be torn any more than she had been. And having been through divorce myself, in fact, I was getting divorced when I did Kramer, there are situations where, I don't want to get too personal, where the child gets the information that they're supposed to choose one parent over the other, which is awful. Mm-hmm. Where a parent says, you know, make a choice.
Yeah.
And that had been a part of this backstory.
I also inferred that there, or got the idea that any person who's good at songwriting, be it even if it's jingle writing, is just, there's a certain element of me and selfishness, and, you know, I got my thing to focus on.
Yes.
I just presume that was part of it too.
Yes. You know. And he did want to be a jazz pianist, which I wanted to be.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I wrote that song.
Uh-huh.
And I played. And
I didn't know that. Okay.
And
what's the name of the piece?
Shoot the Breeze. I didn't write the lyrics. Bette Midler did. In fact, I just did it with Sting at a benefit. It was extraordinary because it has a big reach.
He sang and you
played.
Where was that?
We did it for Oceana, but the first time we ever did it was Carnegie Hall at his Brain Force benefit.
Any chance of a YouTube video being around of that?
I know they videoed the Oceana. I saw a camera because Clinton was there.
Huh. Again, I would love to just find that if I could.
I would too. Hey, Amanda. You know, at that Oceana thing, I saw a video camera. Oh, I didn't know you were on the phone. I saw a video camera when I was at Oceana and I played that thing and Sting sang. Can we get a hold of it? We are? Okay.
once saw him do a benefit once, and he just did a straight a cappella with like four songs. One of the most beautiful things I've ever.
He's extraordinary. Uh-huh. He's a musician.
So you must have rehearsed then, if you did it.
Not
together.
A lot. I didn't want to rehearse at all. He called me up and said, "Do you want to do that?" Because he was supposed to sing a few things, and he said, "Of course I'm going to do it." He said, "Should we just do it?" I said, "Well, maybe you should just come over and run through it once." And anyway, so piano. So I did some research with Jingles, and it didn't start out as that was not his job in the first draft. And we arrived at that. In fact, Joel picked that profession. Found something that I could work with. And jingle writing, it's suggested in the thing, has changed so dramatically. If you try to remember a song from a commercial nowadays, I think it's difficult. But 25 years ago, there were a lot of commercial songs that people knew. Mm-hmm. Now it's, as I said, it's much more electronic, mechanical, and the art is taken out of it. Again, that was just suggested.
Have you ever lived in London for any?
Yes. Yes, I love it.
Yeah. I was just. Maybe it's just nice to be there on top of it.
I love London, and I was, and that was one of the more pleasurable aspects of making the film, because everything we did was on location, and we were blessed because we didn't have bad weather, which we expected to have rain, mostly rain. But we moved the family there when I did a play there, and I was there for almost a year, and the kids were small enough then to put them in school. They developed English accents. It made us nervous.
What was the play?
Merchant of Venice.
Oh, wow. My son's over there now.
Yes?
Syracuse University has an annex, and he's just there for the fall, winter semester.
So was he like 22, 23?
No, junior, 20.
20. I have a daughter, our youngest. She just turned 21, and she did the same thing in Rome last year.
Huh. What school?
Brown. She's now in her last year. Huh. You know, that we didn't have that kind of stuff when we were kids.
Yeah. Well, can you tell me a little bit, just to veer away for a second, when was your, how much did you talk to Sydney?
Sydney?
Pollock. Towards the last few months. Did you have any?
I didn't have any conversation with him. I had conversations through people. He saw very few people. I had conversations through Mike Ovitz, who he had. He had talked to his brother, Bernie Pollock, and that's about it.
Schickel wrote this piece about he needed him to narrate a one of his documentaries, and he just came in. I mean, I didn't think he was getting around much either, but...
When did he do that in terms of when he died?
Maybe 7 months before, 6-7 months before, something like that. I just felt very, very glad because he and I struck up a bit of an email and phone relationship, and I was able to give him 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. I love that he hadn't seen it.
Oh, I love that movie. It's one of my favorite
movies.
Isn't
that something? Yeah.
Wow. Sydney. Sydney?
Yeah.
Wow.
He wanted to see it. He said he hadn't seen it, so I just brought my screener over, and that was the last contact I ever had with him.
I wrote him a letter, and I said, don't respond, just to be courteous, you know. But if you feel like it, I'd love to see you. But I think he was. I was told by Bernie that he didn't want people to see him because he'd lost 50 pounds or something. Uh-huh. Maybe over to him.
Right. I was really looking forward for him doing Recount. I knew he would have done the next one.
I know. And that went to Guy. I had just worked with Jay Roach.
Yeah. You know. But he did an excellent job, too,
yes.
I thought.
Yeah, but that would have been up Sydney's alley, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The there's always, whenever a film is about to come out, people routinely have portions that didn't make it. Is there a DVD version that's going to be somewhat different than what we will or people will see in theaters of Last Chance, Harvey?
I don't understand the question.
Is there going to be extra footage, scenes that you were in love with but didn't fit?
I don't know.
That's kind of like standard these days.
Yeah, there's a scene that I wish had been included in Tootsie, which they didn't put in the DVD.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know why. But it was a scene that that we shot, and it would have been probably one of my favorite scenes, and it was when I was up at the farm. I don't know if that footage exists. I should try to find out. And Charles Durning is swooning all over me, and I start playing the piano. And Charles and I, when we were working there, we did it ourselves because I was playing a little, and between takes, and he started singing, and then I started singing, and then we thought of this scene where he should come, it's like an upright piano, just kind of lean over, looking romantically at me, and I picked the song "Stormy Weather." Which is wonderful because you can use a deep part of your voice. There's no sky, there's no sky, sun up in the sky, stormy weather. And we wanted to, we were hoping he would include that, but it wasn't even included in the, I loved it. In this picture, I don't know, we shot, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is the ending was reshot, and the original ending, I go after her. There's a lot different. And when they were having screenings, what did you call them, where people give comments? I always forget.
Reserve screenings or
not reserved. You know, when they fill out cards and they.
Yeah, well, I think of them as reserve screenings. Or
oh, you used another word before. Yeah. Test whatever.
Test screenings.
And the people didn't like the film that much. I liked it, but not that much because they felt that after the wedding scene, and then particularly that right follows that is Emma's scene about, you know, being pregnant, and that after that point that the film fell off. And what was the original was that I had this heart thing, and I went to the hospital, and there was not much of a fight that I put up to get me out for the appointment that I had with her, so that suddenly it was written that way. So you know, I was there for like 3 days. And they do tests, and then I'm in bed, and it's intercutting with her in the hospital bed, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. And in the meantime, it's intercut with her because she has quit her job, and she is looking for other employment and having interviews for jobs. Mm-hmm. And then I wind up somehow finding her when I get out of the hospital. And she doesn't want anything to do with me. She is coming out of writing class, and she just walks away, and I watch her walk away, and she gets on a bus, and I run, and I get on the bus. She's sitting upstairs, and I look around, and I then go upstairs, and she and I have a scene that took us to the end of the movie. And then we thought about it, and we thought, we could make this better, which is what we wound up with. And to give her, particularly to give her the bookend, the small epiphany that I have at the wedding, to give her, let it be her turn, so that we, in a sense we're like accidental
serendipitous, you mean?
No, when you have a cause and effect on someone, that we're cathartic, that we're accidental cathartics for each other, and because in a sense we help each other, or we not really we allow the other to help himself, which was the idea. She hadn't had that. And I think that balances it better.
When will this film open in England?
I don't know.
But not imminently?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I can ask him to make a phone call. I know Emma was trying to get it for some kind of screening there, but I don't know if she's had any luck.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't talked to her because she's busy writing. But she's coming here in a few days. So I will ask her. She's not seen it, I mean, since it's been.
I was just curious because I thought my son, he's going to go to a couple of plays with a girl he's met over there, and I didn't realize, didn't even hear that there was a Rain Man play going on over there.
Oh, that was going on when we were shooting.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Josh Hartnett.
Yes. And by coincidence, I had been there working a year or two before when The Graduate was open there also. I didn't see either of them. I would have if I could have not caused whatever.
Yeah, a stir.
Yeah, if I could have gone in with a Halloween costume.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was curious. I don't know if it's still playing Rain Man.
It was, and I checked it online. I didn't hear great things about it.
I heard mixed things. I heard that there was nothing in a car, which I thought was interesting, because the whole thing's in it takes place in a car. So when I heard they were doing it, I thought, oh, there's probably a lot of stuff where they're both sitting in a car.
I was just talking to somebody about one of the films that looks pretty good for the end of the year, and mentioned rancor and, you know, disharmony. And I said, well, golly, you know, if a movie doesn't have some pretty fierce disagreements by somebody, it's probably not going to be that good at the end of the day. Do you subscribe to that, or do you believe that a happy set makes the best film? Is there any hard and fast rule? It just seems like good stuff always is a result of people conflicting and maybe, you know.
Well, I like a happy set. I think a happy set is important, but when you say set, I'm thinking of the crew as well as the actors. I've always had a happy set, generally speaking, meaning that I'm thinking of the crew.
Yeah. But, you know, there's nothing so taxing. That's when you go to a movie, from my perspective,
yes,
and it's like everybody, I'm not talking about the
yes,
principals, but everybody and the whole crew is on. Everything is funny.
Yes.
Everything's amusing.
Yeah, I hate it.
Everybody's performing.
The cast and crew screening. They're not to be is that what you mean? They're
no,
not
I mean on the set of a shoot. You know, everybody's very attuned to keeping it up and
yes,
kind of buoyant and positive.
Yes.
And I don't know. I don't know how you can cut through all that, because this doesn't feel real to me. But maybe because if you're in the lead of a film, you don't feel that. It's not. You know.
You mean the crew?
Yeah, crew people, just everybody. Everybody you talk to is kind of on. It's like they're at a party or something, and everybody feels a need to be.
See, I don't know what the perspective
spirited
is from your point of view. I do. My feeling is that it is an artificial on, in the sense that you get psyched up.
Yeah.
It's a crazy way to do art. In other words, 14 hours a day with the same intensity, basically with 2-3 pages.
Right.
That's a demand, which is kind of unnatural. It's, you know, what does a writer do if a writer's sitting down for 12, 14 hours just knocking out 2 pages, which some do, you know,
yeah,
if they hope to get a page. It's
right.
I'm sure it's a painful experience.
Interesting you said 14. Do you know that film that Pascal Wexler made called Who Needs Sleep?
No. I'll get it, though.
It was inspired partly because he felt really badly about two people that he knew who were working really long days, and two of them, they got into car crashes on the way home in the wee hours.
I heard about this. Yes, I remember that.
You know, and like...
It's crew not, people.
Yeah, crew people.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I was saying, well, you know, Haskell, you're a type A personality, and I you know, write a column all the time, and I routinely do 14, and in fact, it's, you know, when you add in going to screenings in the evening, 16, 17 isn't out of the realm. And he says, yeah, but you're no good after 14. You really aren't. I mean, you think you're being productive, but you're just...
Well, Ingmar Bergman didn't think you were any good after 8.
Well, he would just shut it...
Yes. I mean, the metaphor that came to me a long time ago was... I'm not, pretending to be necessarily someone who thinks up good metaphors, but the metaphor that seemed to be accurate was that, let's say you're a painter and you go out to do a landscape and you're looking for the best direction, the best angle, and you finally place your easel at this and you start painting. And so you've committed a few hours to it. And then you let, you've been doing it for, let's say, 6-7 hours, and suddenly you just hear this vibration, and let's say you're 3/4 of the way done or whatever, and you don't know what it is, and suddenly you realize that your easel had been put on a railroad track, and you hadn't been aware of it, and you don't want to shift it, because you don't want to shift the angle of what you're painting, so you're kind of committed to being on that railroad track. And the train, suddenly, and you hear it, and then you see it in the distance, and you start painting faster than you normally would. And because it comes closer, you paint faster, and as it comes closer, you paint faster. And then just before it hits you, you grab your painting and jump out of the way, and that's your movie. And so maybe, that's the truth. It's not just working hard and long hours. Yeah. It's that you're, on a day-to-day basis, you're playing catch-up, because constantly the first AD, I've never been on a film where it didn't exist, goes to a director and says, what shots do you want to give up? Because you're going to have to give up some shots, coverage shots, whatever. Which ones do you want to give up? And it's awful.
But shouldn't every producer or director with any, shouldn't it be, everybody have a Woody Allen clause built in that, you get everything you can, and then you also figure that you're going to have eureka moment. It's going to tell you something else you should have added, and you'll go back and do a couple of days, or whatever.
You're right. I don't know if he still gets it, but he had, I think, like 40% or something, from what I heard. One of the interesting things I also heard was that they screwed him over, because when he would go back to reshoot, they said, "Oh, gee, we'd love to. Yeah, we know it's in the contract, but those sets don't exist anymore." So after they did that to him a few times, he says, I shot everything in front of Rockefeller Center because I know that's not going to, I'm not going to move that. But he took that into consideration. I know there was a film that, My Dinner with Andre was called.
The talking movie with Wallace Shawn. And.
Yes, and the director was, he was married to...
come back.
Kingsburg, and I think.
I know he played John the Baptist in The Last Temptation of Christ.
The director?
The other guy in My Dinner with Andre.
Oh, the other guy. But the director, this is awful. The French director. I'm just, it's happening to me. Anyway, he shot the movie, as I understand it, looked at it, and then said, okay, now I know how to do it, and then reshot it. And because it was all in one place, and I've always felt that that's the way it should be. I know that Chaplin, I think, gave up shooting the Gold Rush halfway through it and just shut down. And he was the laughing stock of the community, because by then, I think we were doing sound films, and they thought Chaplin's still doing silent movies, and then it shut down, and they thought, people were, I think, gloating over the fact that he had gone over the precipice. And I think he worked for 3-4 months, and then went back and reshot the whole movie. That's what should happen. As I understand it, because that's the way other art works. You write, you throw it away, you rewrite, you paint over it. As I understand it, from Kenneth Brownlow's book on movies, is that when movies first began, they were on a tripod, and it was silent, and you cranked it, and then you looked at the rushes, and the purpose of the rushes were to see how you could do it better. And you went out and reshot it, which you do with any art form. Yeah, that's good, but now I can rewrite that scene to be better. I feel that now it's because of the costs and everything, you have to beg to get a reshoot on your knees, sometimes paying it for it. I mean, there's just, Hollywood is rife with stories. Zemeckis and Tom Hanks needed $1 million after they finished.
Castaway.
No. One before Gump. Forrest.
You're right.
They wanted $1 million, and the studio refused to give it to them. And they each put up $500,000 each of their own money to do it. And it's you know, I don't know how else you do good work. I mean, what other art form do you have to get it right the first time, except for bungee jumping, maybe?
Maybe it was naively, I thought all along that with much more, you can certainly light much more quickly with digital and with the red camera. Have you seen the red camera? Have you played with
it? No, but I've always heard, and I even talked to Haskell about this one time, that digital takes just as long to light.
To light, really?
Maybe I'm wrong, but that's, you know, you can use a smaller crew, but I think the lighting can, you know, I don't know what the red, is that?
That's the one that Steven Soderbergh shot all of Che with.
I should look into it.
And it's the most reasonably priced camera that you can actually own. I think it's something not too horrendous in terms of cost. And it's the photography in Che, which interestingly, I've seen it three times.
Is it all handheld? Or most of it?
There's some tripod work. I mean, it's not completely jiggly. It's not like, what's the epitome of the handheld feeling? Rachel Getting Married.
Yes.
Have you seen that?
No, that's handheld.
Very much so. It's dogma-ish, you know.
Yes.
But it's beautiful. Che is. It's really beautiful. And it's different tones. The first half, which is about the Cuban Revolution, is earthier, warmer.
Yes.
And the second half, which is about the failed Bolivian attempt in 67, is, you know, cooler, and but it's so crisp and clean. And he does different aspect ratios. And
is it HD?
That's what the Big Red is, yes.
I see.
Or the Red, whatever it's called. But it's this thing that you can own and superb work. Have you seen, did you ever see Zodiac projected digitally?
I saw Zodiac, but I don't know if I saw it projected digitally. I saw it on a screener.
Okay.
So probably not.
Well, I just thought that the visual qualities of that film, particularly when I saw it at that big Paramount Theater on the lot.
Yes.
They have a digital projection second and perfect.
I don't know of it.
I just thought the values were just, I said, this is really transportational. It's really fantastic. Well, just makes me feel good about, you know, the visual
possibility. You can do it that much cheaper, too. I wonder how many weeks they took to shoot Che. Is it a long film?
4 hours and 20-something minutes.
It's a long film.
It's two movies.
Oh, yes.
You take a break for a half hour.
I see.
That's only going to be for 1 week, and then it'll be shown separately.
You
can see one or the other. And I'm kind of off on an island with maybe five other people, and everybody else is kind of going, it doesn't have any drama. And I said, well, that's what's great about it, because it doesn't try to sell drama, right? It's really, I think it's wonderful.
Well, I can't wait to see it.
The things that I've loved that you've done over the years, I just love it when a movie knows that it's there. You can kind of feel it, and if it knows, then you know, and then the comfort spreads, and then amazing things happen.
It's when the making of it?
No, when a movie is, you can feel it when the director or a movie itself is trying to sell you on the emotionality of the scene, or the, you know. And I just love that sense of command or comfort when a movie seems to really know that it's there, you know. I'm being inarticulate, but...
Are you referring to Last Chance Harvey?
Oh, yeah. That would be one example, because I really felt that it understood itself, and therefore I understood it.
I see. Well, Emma and I did have a large part to do with the film with the director. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to do this movie as like hired hands. Mm-hmm. She had inspired the director, and then we became a kind of a triumvirate. Mm-hmm. And what Emma and I discussed early on, which we brought to the director, was a desire to... I said to Emma, I said, you know that scene that you did in Love Actually, where you find out you're being cheated on? I said, that's one of the most extraordinary pieces of acting I've ever seen on screen. It was Brando-esque in the sense that Brando at his best, where it was past being personal. It's almost like you have to turn your head. Mm. It was so raw, and you were so naked in that. And she agreed with me. She understood why that scene was that she was able to do that in that way. And I said, what if we try to do this movie that way? What if we really play as close to ourselves as we can, so that spiritually we're autobiographical? Emma and I struck up this extraordinary friendship when we did Stranger Than Fiction. We were in Chicago, and it was like a marriage, a creative marriage, and we just loved working together, and we were kind of held by the nature of the film. It was a stylized film, Stranger Than Fiction, so each word we memorized in three dots and comma and all that, because that was the style of it. But in this film, we said, well, what if we leave it open and we can, so we know the nature of the scene, but we may improvise, and they'll be set up for it, maybe sometimes with two cameras. And I've done some films like that with Rain Man. And it's particularly helpful, actually, when you have a writer-director, because he's the writer. So that if he agrees, he can look at the playback, and he says, yeah, keep that, do, you know, whatever. And don't, you know, that doesn't seem to work. But the approach was, in a sense, like, I guess, two actors who had spent careers doing character work. She just finished Nanny McPhee or something.
Yeah.
And we were not thought of as leading man and leading lady. You know, we haven't made our living that way exactly. Like you said, how long has it been? So I said, well, what if we just take it as close to ourselves as possible, and whatever happens, happens. So there was never a pressure. I mean, it's a small budget movie. So you're not out there with studio people saying, and Overture is quite wonderful to work for, by the way, because they're not out there saying, you know, we got to have a hit. They don't want to flop. But at the same time, it was a way of working that when I first started making movies in the late 60s and in the 70s, even going into the 80s, before Jaws, I guess, where you just wanted to do good work. I mean, there was no thought of this has got to be a hit. I mean, you trust in, I think you used the words that there's a certain comfort zone you find yourself in, so that when you're acting, you're feeling, Brando once said, don't pick anything if you can't do it 50 times honestly. Because you can hit this guy a lot of angles.
When did he say that? That's interesting.
A long time ago, I think. I once heard when I was, I think, a struggling actor. But, you know, I mean, that's it. Generally, he didn't mean that every single, but basically what he means is that you can be easy. It should be easy. Once you decide on the nature of the scene and the whatever character, whatever, you get out there, it should, and I don't think I've ever felt freer, and Emma, I think, felt the same way. We were just, you know, we were going, I mean, we knew what we had to do in each scene, but it was a glorious feeling.
I'm curious why or how you came to that resolution towards the end of Last Chance Harvey, when your character decides not to vent, and as I said,
decides
not to vent and go tit for tat with those people who had treated him horribly, and just basically he's very gracious and it just wins you over. I mean, I could see the scene being written somewhat differently. He could have been more. Whatever.
So the question is,
where the idea, where the inspiration came to?
My wife and I wrote the scene the night before.
Okay.
And she's known me for years and years and years, She knew me when I was married the first time. And in fact, I was making Kramer versus Kramer while I was getting divorced. Certain elements we were pulling. When I came and I said to the director the day before that I wasn't that comfortable with what was written. And this was the agreement at the beginning. I mean, Meryl Streep wrote her courtroom scenes and asked the director, and because she said, could I? He says, yes, go ahead. And those monologues that she has in the courtroom, she wrote those. And I said to Joel, I said, can we be set up? Because we were shooting at the Grosvenor House. They gave us a room, and you know, they were going to have a lot of actors there and speaking parts for the wedding, and as long as all the other actors. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do because I want to work on it tonight. But if I come up with something, I don't want to rehearse it, and I want you to have, if you can, more than one camera. You decide with. Love the cinematographer, John DeBorman. You know, you guys want two cameras or three cameras. But that, what you see on the screen, is the first take. Emmett, no one knew what I was going to, I didn't know if I was going to be able to do it. And we set it up, you know, we said, okay, we knew where I was going to be sitting, we knew that I'd stand up, we knew. But the thing itself was very fresh because we had been working on it the night before, and even that morning, and I was quite nervous about it.
Huh. Are you better fresh, or do you get better as you refine? As a rule,
I don't think it can be. I don't know. I'm not. 20, 30 take person. What I do like to do, sometimes you catch it early, sometimes you don't. What I do like to do is I'd love to have an agreement with the director early on that you don't have to cut. So let's say we're doing a scene here, mm-hmm. and then I have to leave. So rather than cut, keep it going. I'll come back, sit down, and then we'll start the scene over, and I'll walk out, because you're supposed to walk, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And he said, and I always will say, keep it going, because it's nice to be able to, because once you cut, it's you cut everything.
Yeah.
You cut mood, you cut everything, because it's cut, and then the cinematographer, invariably, because he's a perfectionist, uh-huh. as he should be, wants to tweak.
Uh-huh.
And before you know it, it's makeup people coming in to take sweat off or whatever, and before you know it, it's 10 minutes. And when you can just, De Niro does very interesting things. You know, there's no rules with movies. It's not the stage. I mean, you're not going on in front of an audience where you have to. There's a certain demand in terms of the craft. But De Niro, and I've worked with him, I think 3 times, something like that. Sometimes the camera will be. Remember Wag the Dog, he did it. We can have done the scene, different angles, and then the camera will be over my shoulder onto Bob, so it's like my point of view. And we were very close together, and we were doing the scene, and then I started to say my line, and he says, wait a second, he just ad-libbed it. And he said his line, and I started to say the line again. He said, wait, let me just get a few of them. And he proceeded to say, whatever it was, the camera's on him, and he's saying, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about.
Did you have a
And he just did it 5 different ways, and then we went on with the scene.
Did you have that sort of agreement with Ulu Grosspark when you made Straight Time?
Ulu and I had great difficulty making Straight Time because I started out as the director. I just cast the crew, and I was shooting. But there was no play back then, and we were shooting up at Folsom Prison, and I was directing it, and producing it, was first artist, and we were improvising, and I would then say to the cinematographer, "How was that take?" And he'd say, "Good." And then the editor, they were both first grade people. The editor was Samuel Steen, who had done The Graduate. The cinematographer was Owen Roisman, and Sam would shake his head and say, "Do it again." So this is going on. And I had to, because you can't really tell when you're doing it. You can tell when you're doing it if it's written. Mm. But if it's improvised and you're in the improvisatory mode, you don't know what the hell. Did I say that? Did I do this? And there's no playback. It hadn't, I think it was 1975. Jerry Lewis invented it, those playbacks. And
when did he first do that? With what film?
I don't know when he started directing. Can he had done television, but
The Bellboy around there.
I don't know. Mm. I don't know. So then I fired myself, and after I seen The Rushes, mm. and Ulu came in because he originally had sent me the project mm. years before, and I turned it down. I didn't feel right for it. And then, so Ulu enters with the cast already cast, the crew already cast, mm. And me was still with a directorial bent, so it was a great conflict that we had in making it. It was an arm wrestle. But did we improvise a lot? A great deal. A great deal.
I have one scene that I just absolutely love, that one where you're with you and Teresa Russell, where she says, "I want to know what's going on here," and I could watch that scene over and over again every day of my life.
You know, Eddie Bunker passed away recently. Eddie Bunker wrote the book, which the screenplay is based on. It's a true story. I mean, he was in San Quentin at the age of 18. He says he was the youngest person ever to be admitted. He's very proud of that. And he wrote that while he was in Q, so to speak. I became very friendly with Eddie Bunker. I hung out with him and ex-convicts for over a year and really hung out with them. And I thought he was such an authority that I relied on him, and every single day of that shoot I wanted Eddie there. So sometimes there would be a lot of tension because Eddie wasn't prompt. he had been a former heroin addict, yeah. and he was on methadone. Okay. So understandably, Ulu would be, you know, close to pulling his hair out, because I says, "I'm not doing it until Eddie gets here," because Eddie corrected constantly. I mean, that's whether if you're talking about the Teresa Russell thing or the banker or any of that, was exactly that was come. I was playing Eddie, and I wanted Eddie to tell me, "How would you do this thing? You know, how would you know?" So I wanted an authenticity, and. I don't know how other actors work, but I always have an audience in my head when I'm making a movie, usually. And it's the audience that I want to get accepted by.
I always point to Straight Time when people say the 70s, the great era of the 70s, came pretty much to an end between the release of Jaws and the release of Star Wars, when I say, but Straight Time came out in 78. I was
it did. You know. I wanted ex-convicts to see that movie and say that's the way it is. Mm. The spine of that movie, which I got from Eddie Bunker, was if you're a star, quote unquote, in the joint, then when you get out, you're an extra. And so that there is sometimes a subconscious or unconscious need, and they call it recidivism, to get back. In fact, part of the vernacular is when you get out, they call it I'm on summer vacation, but I'll be back for when the semester starts again.
And all the 30 years, I've never forgotten that line. Out here is what's in your pockets. In there is who you are.
Yes, and that was was Eddie.
Yeah.
He had a lot of lines. It was one of the most invaluable learning experiences I've ever had. The people that I met who had been incarcerated were really interesting people. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would have wanted to bring them all home to dinner, but
right.
but yeah. Later. And drugs played, and probably still does, but in the 70s when I was hanging out with these people, drugs was the predominant elephant in the room.
Yeah.
It was drugs. And in Quentin, when I got smuggled in there, actually, one day as a convict.
Really?
And I was there for about 6 hours until they found me out.
You got processed in officially, you mean? I mean, you were actually brought in, you mean?
I got snuck in.
Huh.
So that, in other words, I was at that time wearing a mustache and a goatee and long sideburns and dark shades, which is kind of was the look.
Right.
I mean, I don't seem like 4 out of 5 convicts had that look in the inside.
Mm.
And you didn't have to wear a complete prison uniform. You just had to have a piece that was, you could have a Hawaiian shirt if you want, or you could have so I went there many, many times for a year, sometimes with Eddie, and I would get tours, and then Eddie said, "It's not the same, man, it's not the same. You got a tour's not the same." I said, "Well, can you get me in?"
Mm.
And he says, "Let me work on it." So I don't know if I've ever talked about this, but at that time there was a room that was devoted to convicts who were the warden's secretary or whatever, it was typewriters. And it seemed like there was 30 people in a room typing. And I visited that, I don't know why they picked that room, but they picked that room to sneak me in so that I was quote unquote observing them, and then I went to the bathroom. It's like The Godfather, where a gun is hidden behind. Well, here in the bathroom, they had a bag hidden with prison clothing. So I took off my clothes, and I put on the prison clothing and the shades and everything, and the knit cap is a big part of it, like the sailor's knit cap. And I came out, and I just, and it was the help of, hope he's not there anymore, I'm sure he's not, with a chaplain. It was the prison chaplain who was the key. And they walked me through. And I was under the protection of a big guy who was in for life. I think his name was Mike McNabb. I'm not sure if you remember that. And a cocaine deal had gone bad, and I think he had blown a few heads off with a shotgun. So he's in for life, but he was a kind of star at Quentin then. He's big, like 6'2". And he was assigned to be my bodyguard. And he took me all, you know, the yards. He took me on his block, took me into his cell. I'm a convict for that day. And showed me where his shanks were hidden, showed me where his pot was hidden. He wanted to smoke a joint with me. He had a little wooden refrigerator, I mean, just a wooden box in which he had a big square of ice in. He says, "Look at my steaks." He had steaks in there. I mean, he was a star at that. So he, and we just did a lot of stuff. And he introduced me to some convicts there. And then a guard came over at one point. We were outside the cell. And he was suspicious of me for whatever reason. And he asked to see my pass. Because he says, "You're not in this, you're not from," he somehow knew the faces of everybody that was in that block.
Uh-huh.
He says, "You're not in this block." And I says, "No." And I says, and Mike's not saying a word at that point. He's just standing there. And I said, "I'm from another block." I think I just picked it down from E block or whatever. And he said, "Let's see your," and I didn't have it. And he, with that, I had a pea coat on, I remember. He threw me against the wall, facing the wall, and spread your legs and arms, and he searched me immediately. And he felt something in my peacoat pocket and thought it was a gun. "What is that?" And I took it out. I said, it was a tape recorder. It's a pearl recorder is what it's called in those days. "And what the fuck is this?" And I started to explain. I kept looking at Mike, hoping that he was not a word out of Mike. And finally, I said, "I'm Dustin Hoffman." And he's looking at me like I'm crazy. And I had to take my hat off, my glasses off. And I thought he was going to maybe say, "Oh, my God." And once he realized it was me, he was even angrier than he had been before.
using your power to manipulate the system.
And thinking like that it's a very dangerous. Uh-huh. There was one point where, I mean, at that time, and some lines from Straight Time are in there where I talk about the stabbings and you know, that you're not safe anywhere. They can throw kerosene, coffee can filled with kerosene on you when you're in a cell, and throw a match at you, even if you're in protective custody. They, if they want to get you, they get you. But there was the stabbings there were about, if my memory is correct, I think maybe two a week or something. Or 52, over 50 stabbings a year. So that's, or no, 100 or something. So that's like two. I mean, some absurd number. They just come up behind you with a sharpened toothbrush and jab your kidneys. There was one point where Mike and I were on the yard during that day, and I saw ahead of me a convict walking toward me with the shades on. Looked like 100 yards away, and we seemed to be on the same line. And I never got this feeling when we were on a tour. And Mike is next to me talking to me, and I'm listening to him and looking at Mike, and I keep walking, and this guy's coming at me. And I suddenly realized it was an animal thing. We were going to collide if I didn't move, because he wasn't going to move. And that was, I'll never forget, that was a lesson to be learned. That there was that kind of primitive, you know, behavior in a sense of survival.
The only thing that really came close, performance-wise, realism, at least that I believed, to Straight Time is that moment when James Caan talks about what it's like to be inside in Thief, that Michael Mann film. That was the only thing that got close to what
yes,
you guys.
Yes, I thought that. Michael Mann was one of our writers. Straight Time. He hadn't become a director yet.
Okay.
Yes, yes. That was I think he did Thief afterwards. So I think he may have benefited from a lot of research that he did on Straight Time. Mm. But yes, you're right. I remember that.
Mm. So you have, if I could shift over, just a friend of mine, Rod Lurie, is doing a remake of...
Yes, I talked with him about it some time ago.
And
Straw Dogs.
And there is somebody, I didn't read this, this is why I'm asking, that you thought would be good as David, the mathematician. I'm trying to remember. Did you say that to him?
I think it's Sting's name, by the way. Sting's real name is Sumner.
Uh-huh.
And I think the character in Straw Dogs was David
Sumner.
Right,
David Sumner.
Yeah.
Did you have somebody in mind that
I
you
thought?
I think
I told him, and now he probably can't remember who I don't remember who I mentioned. There's a few actors. I mean, one of my favorite young actors is Gosling.
He'd be excellent.
Yeah.
In that.
He's a wonderful actor.
I even liked him in that relatively straightforward thriller thing. He was really good in that with Anthony Hopkins.
Remember that one? I didn't see it.
He was a prosecutor. I forget what it was called now.
You and me, we're not going to remember. Oh, God. That French director's name. It's driving me crazy.
Gosling would be perfect.
Just slipped. He did that great... He did many great films, but he did... Au revoir, that film about kids during Nazi Germany.
Okay.
This was not good.
Are you a running fanatic the way you used to be?
Do I run?
No.
I stopped running because it really, I don't know how people do it after so many years because on the concrete, so because it is not good for your ankles and your knees. In fact, I saw a knee specialist recently. Not for me, for a friend, and he's one of the best in LA. Clapper, and he said the majority of his business comes from people who run in their 30s. Mm. So I do bike, I do roll weights, and I played, I went to tennis, and then I had a rotator cuff injury a year and a half, so I'm just going to start to get back to tennis. But the treadmill is good too, you can do treadmill. What's his name told me, this is awful. but a friend, a former pro basketball player. Mm-hmm. Gosh, who was that? Not my. But he told me that his knees are shot, not from basketball, but from the Stairmaster.
What a Bruce Stern story. He must have encountered the same thing.
Well, but Bruce Stern made us all look like,
yeah,
you know, nothing. I mean, he'd run from the studio in Burbank to Malibu.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he was past serious.
Let me do the political question, because we're coming to the end here.
Please.
What are you doing, if anything, this evening? Any kind of celebrating with anybody? Is there any kind of gathering that you're attending?
Yes, I'm going to some friend's house, just a few people. And
I'm presuming a celebration.
Well, aren't we all? Yeah. No matter who we're for, I voted for Obama. I have to call him because I from watching CNN last night, they say that around 7:30, 8 o'clock Eastern time, Virginia will have come in. And if Virginia goes very strongly Obama, that may say it.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, and then I think Philadelphia or Pennsylvania comes close behind. If that's the case, that's 5 o'clock. By the time, if he's having people at 7, then it's 10 o'clock. There's nothing to walk. There's no excitement.
No.
So I should call him today and say, maybe you should start this thing about 5 in the afternoon.
Yeah. You know. Certainly by 6, right?
Because I would think so.
That's the end of Pennsylvania.
It is extraordinary how the effect it's had on me and so many of us. And I do have feelings of, because you do naturally analyze, why do I feel this strong? Why does everyone feel this strong? My wife is in New York, and she was getting dressed for her appointment, and she had the TV on, CNN, and when I talked to her this morning, she said, have you been watching CNN? I said, no. I said, why? I said, Stuart. She says, you have to turn it on. She says, they keep shooting have cameras all over the country, and they keep going to different precincts, and lines after lines after lines. She says, I've just been crying all morning, just watching, seeing the lines. It's so moving, and I think, I saw a film last night that it's so haunting, and so a documentary, and it's so ironic that I would be seeing that film the night before the election.
Cool.
It's a must, and unfortunately, some of these documentaries that are musts just don't get an audience. It's shocking. And this was on television. I had heard that it was going to be on TV only in New York, and I was already out here, and my office was KCET, and they got a copy. It's called Torturing Democracy. I'll give you, I had them run some copies off. It's past frightening. It talks about the torture that we have been doing since 9/11.
Yeah.
But it goes into it in a way that I've never, it's not just the photographs that we saw, starting in Guantanamo and then moving over to Iraq, Abu Ghraib, however you say it, and get searching up old CIA methods of torture that they had heard about. And some of these tortures, as they show with drawings from the Middle Ages, date back to the Inquisition, hanging by your wrists, and they have photographs of that, waterboarding. They had other names for it, but these were tortures used in the Inquisition. And holding people without, you know, we're bending the, well, bending, I mean, snapping like a twig the Constitution from the committee that worked under, I don't want to get this wrong, but the lawyers, it's, you know, that were working along with Cheney, so that they would be protected and move and getting, and he'd have a once a week lunch with Bush, and on one of those lunches he got Bush to sign off, which basically said exactly, in fact, what Nixon said, and that Frost Nixon is coming out. if the president does it, it's not illegal.
Right.
That's the famous sentence. That, mm-hmm. Well, basically, this piece of paper said that. This and the Congress overwhelmingly voted in favor. That they don't have to be charged. They could be kept for years and years and years, which some of them have been.
Right.
No charges, mm-hmm. and it's up for the president to decide what is torture and what is. In fact, there's this one moment in the press conference where he says, you know, because the Supreme Court voted him down, and he said, you know, torture, that torture's not allowed. You see Bush saying that outside press conference, and he says, I mean, that's so vague. What does that mean? And you've already seen such documentation of what is going on. And what one man says, and they have interviews from really top people that were in the administration and from different walks of life, whether it's former CIA people, former lawyers, former military people, people that work there. And one man says the damage that this has done to America is going to take decades, because this now opens up a treatment of our soldiers in the future to be used against us.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it as eloquently as this guy said it, but to see that last night and then to see and then to be a part of this today, and this, and I think you can, there's layers of an awareness of this country that which based itself on the opposite of this kind of, you know, behavior, that we became an immoral country in this sense, along with two elections, which I don't care what side of the fence you're on, are very suspect, where the Supreme Court, you know, said, no, you can't recount, and the machines that were fixed, and the chads, and I mean, and the lying about why we went to war. There's so many layers of this that this day in America, that we as this is 8 years of we've paid we've paid our dues for today. I guess it's, what were you going to say?
That someone said on MSNBC this morning that if Obama's being certainly the Democratic nominee, if not the president-elect, it's certainly an outgrowth of the 60s and
Vietnam War,
and just the changing attitudes about race, and as Justice Sarah Palin is an outgrowth of the women's movement, ironically.
I know.
But I was just wondering if there's any kind of generational echo that what this means to you, or how it feels to you.
Well, there's a difference, I think, because Johnson took a hit, which he didn't deserve, really. He inherited a war, which really had been started under Kennedy. And the irony with Johnson was, because he was not liked and vilified, I think was responsible for more liberal legislation being passed than any president in the 20th century, or any president, for that matter, maybe. And so his desire not to run again, because I think he lost in New Hampshire against McCarthy, it was the students. I can show you something, because I do have to go. I'll ask you.
Amanda, can you put up that UNESCO thing?
UNICEF,
I'm sorry.
It's much easier to just... a few years ago, I was promoting a film in Berlin, at the Berlin Film Festival, and after it was over, it concluded for me days of the aptly named junket, the Berlin junket for this film, and when you do so many interviews, 50 a day, whatever, I was so tired, and I thought, okay, now I can just go out and have a meal and have a few drinks, and I'm in a tuxedo, and at that moment, somebody comes up to me and says, Mr. Hoffman, please, UNICEF is having a benefit tonight. Will you please come? I said, what? He said, all you have to do is just sit there. Just sit. You have your suit on. It's like a last minute thing. And I said, okay. Do you have alcohol? I can't have a drink. Yes, yes, yes. And I go there. You know, it's a gorgeous hall with balcony. Looked like an old opera house. I don't know, 1,000 people, whatever. I saw Jack Valenti there. I saw, I can't remember, one of the guys that once played Bond. There was a few other people, mm-hmm. Americans, but, you know, I guess mainly Germans. And on the stage was a long rectangular photograph of a third world country boy, you know, because that's what it's about. And midway through the meal, this same lady comes up, and when I went in, I had to get past a phalanx of photographers and journalists, I guess, and suddenly asking me about what my position was on the impending war with Iraq. So I don't know, was that 6 years ago?
2003.
Huh?
Well, the 2003 is when the invasion happened.
Is that it? And so it's five and a half years. So suddenly she comes and I answer, and then I'm eating, and then this gal comes up and says, "Would you speak, please?" I said, "What?" I said, "Speak what?" She says, "Just your feelings, please, about what." I said, "I don't know what to say." And she keeps at it and says, "You can just say whatever you want to say, just about in terms of what we're trying to do, and just, you know." And I'd had a drink, so I, you know, whatever. If without a drink, I would have been steadfast, no, but I said, oh, okay, but you got to give me time to make some notes. And I made some notes on a napkin or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I got up and I spoke, not thinking about anything. When you're asking me these questions, it happens to have been a strong part of me for years. And I thought, oh, it's like 6 minutes long. I can play it for you. Just setting it up. But with all this technology, we are not the information. That's why Obama's coming across so strongly, because somehow he's getting through to us with the emotional information as well as the intellectual information. And we're cut off. I guess it's just human. There's so much information on a daily basis now that it becomes abstracted, you know. So if you read about 200 people dying in an earthquake, and then 2 minutes, you read it in the paper, and 2 minutes later, some little dog crosses the street and gets run over by a car, it's the dog that has a bigger effect on you, you know. Because the other, we can't get through a day otherwise. And last night, seeing this this documentary called Torturing Democracy, which I thought was really well done.
Can I get it?
I'm going to give you a copy.
Oh, great.
And I'd love to hear your response. It everything you thought you knew, you didn't. You don't.
Right.
At least I didn't. And one of the things, one of the higher-ups in the administration, I think Richard Armitage or something like that, said, you know, this torturing, this desire, he says, I just don't get it. He said, the methods that they took from the KGB, and they took from old CIA things, and they took, you know, thank you, we'll be right there, was basically, and used against GIs during the Korean War, and then later, even in the Vietnam, that was basically done to torture people into saying whatever, you'd say whatever they asked you. But that was for propaganda reasons.
Right.
This is for intelligence. How could anybody with half a brain think that you can torture someone to get them to give over information that can be trusted?
Yeah.
I mean, if they torture you, I mean, how long is it going to take you to say, did you try to kill Bush in the middle of Grand Central Station? Yes, that was me. I mean, it's not going to take you long to do that. That is, you know, that the methodology was so insane. They were using the same methods. I shouldn't be using it at all. But for propaganda, sure, they get up in the pilots that were shot over North Korea and were shot down, and they were saying, yes, we were carrying poison bombs or whatever, and you know, it was all, and it was videotaped and shown. It was for propagandistic reasons, not for intelligence.
Yeah.
And it's like you see these, anyways.
Is this thing you're going to, by the way, is this an Irina Medavoy thing?
Are they
doing something?
No, it's like six people. They're just they're friends, but I don't think you'd know the names. They're not even in the business. I think there's one guy that writes TV, but they're people that my wife and I just know. I didn't even know there was anything. They're having things. I'm rarely on a list because I've never gone, so people suddenly just stop asking.
You know, when you write your own stuff, I mean, you know, you wrote the Last Chance Harvey thing. I've always thought that the things that you've said at the Oscar Awards are very well written, very, very thoughtful, better than what most people were saying. You're a pretty good writer.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to admit to myself that I can. I've been trying to write something that's been taking me a few years. Anyways, you'll see this, which is which is literally not written, but just, you know, just, you can tell me what you think. I'm going to run to the bathroom.
Okay.